this angel dust PCP, that's something I heard about when I was a kid. That's kind of scary and strange. Are we still using it?
No, because it's scary and strange.
Law and Stuart, welcome to my podcast, Verdensrommet.
Thank you. It's fantastic to be here.
We're currently at NPV's conference for psychedelic science, and you had your talk, and you also sat at the panel. What's your job here?
I'm part of the original group that started the Norwegian Association for Psychedelic Science, and I'm also part of the research team SeekForsk, working with Compass on psilocybin and MAPS on MDMA therapy, and part of a larger group of people that are trying to increase access to psychedelic medicines in Norway and Scandinavia, and continue to do research on psychedelics in Norway.
Yeah, and you're doing ketamine treatments for depression as well. I want to come back to that, but I wanted to ask you like five quickies first, just to get to know you a little bit. So, okay, who would you eat dinner with? Any person, dead or alive?
Bob Marley.
Wow. Would you be rich or poor and guaranteed happy?
Definitely poor and guaranteed happy.
Politically correct answer. Good. At what age will you die?
Hopefully not too soon.
What's your favorite planet?
Earth.
And lastly, but maybe the biggest, what makes you happy alone?
Human connection.
Cool. Okay, back to ketamine. You're treating the treatment-resistant depression patient with ketamine with high success. What is the reason that ketamine is showing these promising results already?
Well, we're still trying to, research and understand the many mechanisms of how ketamine works, both for depression, but also other mental health disorders and addiction as well. Fundamentally, if we start sort of at the lowest, smallest part of the brain, the brain cells, ketamine stimulates neuroplasticity or neurogenesis, increased branching and connections between the brain cells. And what that does is it normalizes the effects of chronic stress states on the brain. So chronic stress, whether it's depression or other stress throughout your life, actually decreases the number of branches and connections between the brain cells. And that translates into cognitive rigidity, being sort of stuck in certain patterns. You have less options between pathways between brain cells. And so by normalizing the neuroplasticity, it acts as, we use a metaphor of like having new snow on the mountain. So instead of having to take the same old tracks that you're stuck in, you have the possibility and flexibility to take other pathways. So it doesn't erase anything, but increases flexibility and resilience in both thinking, feeling, and patterns of behavior. At a slightly higher level with electrical networks in the brain, there are a number of pathological or networks that are hyper or hypoactive in the brain in chronic stress states, and ketamine can also normalize those, or sort of resetting the computer or the software that's maybe dysfunctioning for whatever reason can kind of set it back to a more normal state and
sustainable state. It sounds like this Swedish button that we're pressing on the computer to get it back running and starting from fresh.
Yeah, exactly. And there are a couple important networks. One of them that we talk a lot about in with the mechanisms of other psychedelics as well, the default mode network, that people have hyperactivity in this where it's manifested by rumination, just thinking about the future, the past, which is the opposite of being in a flow state and just being in the present moment. So ketamine can shift towards a little more into the direction of just being in the present moment where it's less easy to feel anxious or depressed. And another area of the brain that it normalizes the function is the prefrontal cortex, which is the sort of your top-down regulation of emotions. And so you can normalize that function.
I can relate to this flow stage, because when I have flow stage, I'm not thinking about the past or the future. I'm just there, and the hours just went along. When I'm carpenting or doing something I like or doing podcasting, for example, I'm trying to get into flow state here now. But this sounds like we have a pretty good understanding of what's going on in the brain. But I would take a guess that that's not why we ended up trying ketamine for the first time. How did, is this an accident like a lot of things, champagne and everything? How did we start this in the first place?
Yeah, so ketamine was synthesized in 1962 as an alternative anesthetic to PCP, angel dust, which was actually used as an anesthetic, but had prolonged severe side effects. And so ketamine is still used today as an anesthetic. But one of the, when it was first used, it was tested on human prisoners in 1964. And even the first time that humans got ketamine, they reported these, healthy controls. Now, who's really totally healthy in prison? They're probably a little depressed and anxious being in prison, being tested on by the by people. And they reported the next day positive changes in their mood. Those findings weren't really picked up so much by academic researchers, but it was the psychoactive properties, the psychedelic properties of this anesthetic were picked up by doctors and therapists that were using psychedelics in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And the approval of ketamine in 1970 coincided directly with the ban on all other psychedelic medicines at that time. As they all became illegal, ketamine became a legal medicine. So there was a number of therapists and doctors throughout the world that continued using it for its psychoactive properties in mental health disorders.
Right. So I'm a little curious, because this angel dust PCP, that's something I heard about when I was a kid. That's kind of was scary and strange and everything. I haven't heard about that for several years. Are we still using it?
No, because it's scary and strange.
So, is it a psychedelic or is it a...
Yeah, it's very... It has some similar properties to ketamine in that it's a what we call a dissociative right. psychedelic or anesthetic. But it's causes much more confusion and agitation and delirium that are sort of prolonged and other... medical side effects as well, so it's not really sought out. There are a lot of other drugs that reliably produce positive experiences, you know, for people to take recreationally that are available now. So that's why it really doesn't exist as a drug of abuse anymore.
Yeah, that sounds logical. I guess the science is still out on the several areas, but ketamine shows obviously both promising results and already in use. Would you think that something is going to replace ketamine that has even lesser of side effects, or do you think this is it?
Well, you know, there's always new medicines being developed. Certainly, it's possible. But usually, you know, the reason we replace a medication is if it either has less side effects or better positive outcome. And there's actually few medicines in the world that are less toxic than ketamine when used infrequently. So ketamine, you know, we use it in child anesthesia because of its safety. We use it in people that have severe medical problems and trauma. So it's the safest anesthetic because it sort of maintains the function of your body, so it doesn't disturb the normal processes in your body, and it's really non-toxic to the organ systems. And yet it provides profound psychoactive effects that are necessary for the therapeutic mental health effects, and profound anesthesia when we use it at higher doses. But the dose that we use in mental health is, you know, about an eighth of the dose I would give a four-year-old child. You know, because of its safety, it's on the World Health Organization list of essential medicines. You know, it's one of the most widely used medicines in the world. So I don't think ketamine is going away in medicine in general, and certainly not in mental health. Because one, very very safe medicine, but two, it's very effective. So if we just take depression, for example, it has a effect size which is very close to that of ECT, which is the most effective, sort of the gold standard electroconvulsive therapy for severe depression.
Is that also a kind of a reset button in some way?
Yeah. It's sort of a reset of the electrical networks by inducing seizure activity in the brain. But it also stimulates neuroplasticity, similar to the psychedelics. But ketamine does it in a way, I don't know if it's a fair metaphor, but I sometimes say, you know, ketamine is a screwdriver and ECT is a hammer. So there's a lot of side effects, such as cognitive impairment, loss of memory, that can happen with ECT that you don't see with ketamine treatment.
Right. I'm not a conspiracy kind of person, but as far as I know, ketamine has a trip length of about 50 minutes, right? Something like around there. And that correlates very much to the time 1 hour with a therapist. It seems like you made this yourself to make money. It is perfect. It's a joke question, but for example, if you compare it with psilocybin, which has 4 to 6 to 8 hours or something like that, LSD 12, 14, it's obviously more well suited to a therapeutic session, and you can treat like 6 to 8 people every day.
Yeah. So the duration of the ketamine experience depends on the dose. And it depends on the route. Of course, if you do an intravenous infusion, you can give it as long as you want. But it's true with a bolus dose, it generally is about 45 minutes at the dose range that we usually use. That is helpful to the sort of clinical implementation, but It's not a conspiracy. It was actually when we did the initial clinical trials for intravenous ketamine for treatment-resistant depression, the model, which is often referred to as the National Institute of Mental Health sort of protocol, was a 40-minute infusion given 3 times a week. And that was chosen exactly because it fits into a model where they could do it in a clinic or in a hospital setting where it's easy. So the 40 minutes was chosen for that exact reason. Since then, you know, we've done studies on different ways to do it, and it's a little unclear. You know, people have done longer infusions, 96-hour infusion for chronic pain. There's studies where they do an infusion over an entire week where you're literally on a ketamine drip for a week straight with a catheter in your bladder so you can pee and...
Wow. That's a bit strange waking up from a coma-like state.
Yeah, well, the interesting thing is, so I've done pain treatments where people do 5-hour treatments 5 days in a row, and because time and space is relative, both actually and perceptually in the experience, people don't, you know, you could do a 5-hour ketamine experience and they'll wake up and say, that felt like it was 5 minutes, or a 1-hour infusion and they wake up and say, that felt like it was 5 years. So time is relative to your experience.
Like the Einstein drug, the speed of light or something. Yeah. I think you answered another question I have, because I wanted to know if ketamine was also a victim of the Nixon administration and the war on drugs, and you answered that. But another question related to that is, in this conference, I've seen a lot of results, positive results, promising results, both from bigger studies and smaller studies. It's especially when you compare it to other fields, social fields, where we had this publication crisis and low significance and everything. It seems very strange to me that things are not going faster, since the results are one of the best fields I've seen in the last years, in especially psychology. So why is this backlash still happening?
Yeah, it's a good question. I mean, so one is just the process of drug approval is a long process in of itself. So that it does take time to do large trials, to go through, you know, the way we do it now with evidence-based medicine. However, you know, the other is that there is still a lot of stigma against using a, you know, quote, drug of abuse or drug, any kind of psychoactive drug that could also be recreationally used in a medical way. Of course, that's a completely false dichotomy. There, you know, we today, of course, use amphetamines for ADHD. We use morphine, which is almost the same as heroin for pain, benzodiazepines for anxiety. But the, you know, particularly the psychedelics seem scary to medical professionals and to the public as whole, partially because of the 1960s, and also because it's a really different paradigm. It's not just a new pill that you could take at home. But it is, you know, a medicine that has both neurobiological effects, but also profound psychological experiential effects that are very different than normal drugs that we're used to giving as doctors.
Yeah, exactly. And I had Andreas Wahl Blomqvist visiting earlier, and we were talking about... The effect of language has on our culture and minds. Of course, if you have a preconception of heroin being dangerous, why do you give morphine to your grandmother when she loses her hip? I would guess that ketamine is not that well known. And if I, for example, ask my family or mother or father, my father is a veterinarian, so he knows, but I don't think that ketamine is popped up as, oh my God, that's dangerous, because it's kind of not that known. So you have kind of a free ride there. So you can all, as far as I can understand, you can already now, as you're doing, treat people today without any other authorization than being a doctor, because you're giving them anesthesia, but your motivation is to treat depression. How long are we from having that kind of possibility with psilocybin, for example?
So, you know, both psilocybin and there, so with psilocybin, there are compasses in starting phase three trial, which is, you know, the last phase prior to approval. And MAPS has already done phase three, not yet here in Europe, but we'll be starting a phase three trial hopefully in the fall. So, you know, within the next 2 to 3 years, these other psychedelics are going to become available as approved medicines in both the United States first, and then shortly after Europe.
Yeah. So how does this work? If US kind of approves this through NDA approval, will it automatically be able to use here in the Norway, or are we dependent on the European Union, or can we do stuff ourselves? How does this work?
Yeah, unfortunately, the way it works is the European Medicines Association doesn't accept data from the FDA. So you could have a drug that was, you know, went through all the trials that was shown to be effective and safe, but that's not good enough for.
Why is that? That sounds like something Trump would do.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not sure what the rationale is. I mean, you could, you know, I guess theoretically argue that there's some genetic differences in different, you know, there are genetic differences in different populations, and that it's important to test drugs in different populations in different regions in the world. Of course, we're all Homo sapiens sapiens, but there are, you know, different populations that respond differently to medications various drugs. So maybe the rationale comes from that. Although, you know, as we become more and more globalized, it kind of becomes less relevant.
Yeah, but, and it's a politically kind of a minefield also, because I don't know if this is true, but genetic variance in Africa alone is bigger than the rest of the world. So let's try something before we close the door. But yeah. Regarding genetics, starting to get to the end here, Lohan, but I understand there's some indications that there is some heredity in depression and anxiety, that there's, of course, not one gene, but you will more likely have it if your parents had it, and so on. Do you see any patterns in your treatment that some people are less treatable than others due to the fact of genetics?
Yeah, no, that's a really important question. So, you know, generally we think of, you know, probably about, 50% of your risk is genetic, and then there's this another 50% that's social, environmental, and everything else beyond that. And then the interaction between the two. We don't see any clear differences in people with, whether you call it endogenous depression or, you know, sort of a more genetic depression, or versus something that's more environmental because of some stressors that happened in your life. In terms of the response to ketamine, there are some genetic predictors of response. So people who have close family members who had alcoholism are more likely to respond, to have a positive response, antidepressant response from ketamine. So that could be because of, you know, genetic differences in the NMDA receptor that ketamine binds to. And that's one of the few times in somebody's life where I can tell them, like, that's great that you had an alcoholic father. That's a good thing here. We can, there's a slightly better chance of a good response.
Right. Okay. Cool. It's amazing that you do what you do. I think we should open our eyes more to different treatments. We should also be kind of clear minded as well, because it's, I feel it myself. It's easy to be newly blessed in a way of all the different treatments. We should have our heads warmly cold and look at the evidence. And of course, if you treat people that with ketamine or psilocybin and at the same time use therapy sessions, we have to know what's working and what's not working. So keep up the good work. And thank you very much, Lovan, for coming here.
Thank you very much. Yeah.